on this edition for Saturday, July 10th. Haiti in turmoil in the aftermath of the assassination of its president. After years of debate, Confederate statues come down in Charlottesville, Virginia. And new economic opportunity where the steel industry once dominated. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, the Anderson Family Fund, the estate of Worthington Mayo Smith, the Leonard and Norma Clorfine Foundation, the Rosalind P. Walter Foundation, Koo and Patricia Ewan, committed to bridging cultural differences in our communities, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
For 25 years, Consumer Cellular's goal has been to provide wireless service that helps people communicate and connect. We offer a variety of no-contract plans, and our U.S.-based customer service team can help find one that fits you. To learn more, visit consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening and thank you for joining us. Haiti's interim government is asking the United States and the United Nations to send troops in the wake of the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse on Wednesday. Interim Prime Minister Claude Joseph made the extraordinary request for military help to protect critical infrastructure, including fuel reserves, the airport, and the port. As of this afternoon, the U.S. has pledged to send only FBI and Homeland Security officials to help investigate the assassination. Yesterday, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said there were no plans to provide military assistance. Haitian First Lady Martine Moïse was seriously injured in the brazen attack on Wednesday morning and is recovering in a hospital in Florida. In an audio recording released today, she called on Haitians to not let her husband's death be in vain. 20 people have been arrested so far. The majority are Colombians who are believed to be hired mercenaries. Two U.S. citizens of Haitian descent were also arrested. At least five people are still being sought in connection with the assassination. In Port-au-Prince, vigilantes patrolled the streets looking for suspects. Yesterday, security forces killed three suspects in gunfights. Amid the growing chaos, more than 1,000 people gathered outside the U.S. Embassy hoping for a way out of the country.
I'm scared. There are many gunshots, and you don't even know where they are coming from. I have abandoned my home. I can't go back. I don't know about my family.
We will have more on this following the news summary. In Charlottesville, Virginia, this morning, two Confederate monuments at the center of the deadly 2017 white supremacist Unite the Right rally were removed. Dozens of spectators watched as the first statue of General Robert E. Lee was lifted from its stone pedestal. At the event, Charlottesville's mayor said taking the statues down is one small step in what she called the sin of destroying black people for economic gain.
As this community and our country attempts to reconcile with this hypothesis of white supremacy, I hope that we can move to an authentic healing by embracing truth.
Crews also removed a second Confederate monument dedicated to General Thomas Stonewall Jackson. The removals follow years of national debate and a long legal fight. The statues will be stored in a secure location until the city council makes a final decision about what to do with them. New cases of the coronavirus are up 52% in the United States on average over the past 14 days, although the numbers are still far below peak levels. Hotspots are growing in several states, primarily where vaccination rates are low. The New York Times tracking data shows Arkansas with a 140% increase in cases. Only 35% of people in Arkansas are fully vaccinated, well below the 48% nationwide. Globally, the Delta variant continues to cause shutdowns and new restrictions. In Australia, the region surrounding the country's largest city reported its largest daily increase in cases today. Sydney's 5 million residents are in the midst of a three-week lockdown, which may be extended. 79% of people hospitalized there are unvaccinated. Officials say no fully vaccinated people have required hospitalization. President Joe Biden has fired the head of the Social Security Administration after Commissioner Andrew Saul refused to resign. Former President Trump appointed Saul in 2018, and he was confirmed by the Senate the following year for a six-year term. President Biden made the decision after a legal opinion from the Justice Department found that Saul could be fired at will, even though a statute says that the commissioner can only be fired for cause. The Social Security Administration is responsible for distributing benefits to about 64 million Americans. Senate Finance Committee Chair Democrat Ron Wyden applauded the decision, saying in a statement that, quote, every president should choose the personnel that will best carry out their vision for the country. And he pledged to confirm a new commissioner, quote, as swiftly as possible. Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell tweeted that he believes the firing would be, quote, an unprecedented and dangerous politicization of the Social Security Administration. A heat wave is scorching the western states this weekend, with some high temperatures expected to be 20 degrees or more above average. More than 28 million people endure triple-digit heat, the majority in Arizona, Nevada, and California's Central Valley. Washington State and some parts of western Canada could also see 100-degree temperatures. California's Death Valley hit 130 degrees yesterday, matching the hottest temperature observed anywhere on Earth since July 7, 1931. Authorities in California declared a state of emergency in 50 of its 58 counties and asked residents to voluntarily conserve power and cut water use to avoid outages. This time last year, just over 20% of California was in severe drought. This year, that number has spiked to 95%, fueling fires north of Lake Tahoe yesterday and forcing evacuations. For more national and international news, visit pbs.org/newshour. As we reported at the top of the program, the crisis in Haiti after the assassination of its president is continuing, and officials there are asking for help. I spoke with Marlene Dout, professor of African Diaspora Studies at the University of Virginia, about Haiti's history, what may come next, and the current political situation there.
Politically in Haiti right now, there's a lot of confusion. There's confusion about who is running the country. We have two prime ministers, sort of in quotation marks, claiming that they are running the country. So that would be Claude Joseph and Ariel Henry. We also have the UN special envoy declaring that it's Joseph who is in charge. There's a question about whether or not she actually has the authority to proclaim that. And so there's a lot of people asking that same question without a whole lot of answers that are definitive.
So how does this translate into the functioning of government when there is a question of whose order ultimately to follow? I mean, when you talk about the Supreme Court or you talk about any kind of administrative duty or responsibility that a government has.
There are actually very few elected officials and government officials in place at the moment. And the reason for that is that President Moïse had allowed parliament to lapse. And so the parliament was essentially dissolved and has been in that state for more than a year. So he's been ruling by what is called decree and essentially running the government on his own. The reason for the confusion about the prime minister is that he had declared a new prime minister was to take office, but that person, Henri, had not yet been sworn in. So I think there's actually, and with the Supreme Court justice having died of COVID recently, which is sort of another strain in the story of President Moïse's lack of really responding to the COVID-19 crisis and getting vaccinations for the Haitian people, especially. So there's really a power vacuum when people say that. In this case, it's not just a metaphor. It's actually very true, where we see nobody really knows who's in charge or who has the authority to even say who would be in charge.
But what do you gather from the composition of the group of people who were part of the assassination?
It's very interesting. So the majority of them appear to be Colombian nationals with two Haitian Americans. I think that the composition of that group says a lot about, who they are, but doesn't necessarily tell us anything really about who sent them. And that to me is what is the most interesting part of this puzzle, which really does remain a puzzle at this moment, is that it doesn't appear to be that the Colombian government is involved, although these are early days. And I suspect that the interrogations will continue to reveal new information, whether or not that information given by those arrested is to be also trusted is another story.
What do you see happening in this sort of shorter to medium term?
Well, this is really up in the air. I think that in the short term, both an internal investigation, which is being conducted by the police force in Haiti, needs to occur. But I think that there does need to be some external investigations in terms of who exactly is funding this. You would need a lot of money to send this convoy with this many people armed this heavily with their vehicles, and to figure out who are all the players involved in this and if there is not some larger story. Because it seems to me that the easy answer is to say that the Haitian opposition groups must be responsible, but it seems to me that with this knowledge of who the makeup of the assassins, that there is likely a larger story that will need to be uncovered.
All right, University of Virginia Professor Marlene Dowd, thanks so much.
Thank you.
For more than 100 years, a steel mill on the Patapsco River near Baltimore was a major economic driver of the region. At its height in the 1950s, it employed tens of thousands of workers. When it closed for good almost a decade ago, few people thought the economic prosperity it provided could ever be replaced. But over the last several years, a new set of businesses has risen at the site of the former steel mill and ushered in an economic transition that reflects the new landscape of jobs in today's American economy. NewsHour Weekend special correspondent Carla Murthy has our story from Maryland.
So this was specifically built for black families.
Yes.
68-year-old Larry Bannerman grew up in Turner Station, an historically black neighborhood in Baltimore County, Maryland.
It was open doors, people left the keys in their car. Everybody's parents watched everybody's children. It was like Mayberry, like a black Mayberry. It was great.
He says a big reason it was so great is because there were plenty of good-paying jobs for residents, including his family, just across the bay in Sparrows Point at the steel mill that had been operating there since 1889.
There was no place in Turner Station you could go and not hear and see what was happening at Sparrows Point.
At its height in the 1950s, the Bethlehem Steel Mill was the largest mill in the world and employed 30,000 people. Union workers were paid wages that supported their families and built thriving middle-class neighborhoods.
It was the economic powerhouse for this community. It enabled this community to grow, enabled residents to send their kids to college.
But as the American steel industry collapsed from overseas competition and disinvestment, so did Bethlehem Steel, which eventually went bankrupt in 2001. Over the next 10 years, four other companies tried to make steel at Sparrows Point, but also failed. In 2012, this once mighty industrial center went silent.
How did that affect Turner Station? How did it affect the community here?
People who lost their homes, there were people who lost everything. I mean, we watched the blast furnace where our parents worked be blown up. I mean, they actually blew it up. And the thing fell over like a big lump. And I mean, you know, so did the hearts. Nobody believed they could replace it.
But almost a decade after the steel mills shut down, a new economic landscape is rising from Sparrows Point.
Instead of steel mills and smoke, the view now is
it was all blue and white.
In 2018, Amazon opened an 855,000-square-foot fulfillment warehouse, and last year opened a second that's over 1 million square feet. FedEx, Under Armour, and BMW are some of the 30 companies that have opened distribution centers on the former steel mill site that's now called TradePoint Atlantic.
It's a very diverse set of businesses operating on site, and they're defining the new economy that has taken shape over the last 10 years.
Aaron Tamarchio is the Executive Vice President of Corporate Affairs at TradePoint Atlantic. Its parent company, Redwood Capital Investments, acquired the 3,300-acre site for a reported $150 million. Tamarkio says the growth of e-commerce has fueled the transformation of Sparrows Point into a global distribution hub.
What is really unique about this property is the convergence of all of this infrastructure assets that were left over from a 19th century steel mill and are now being repurposed.
For instance, the site has access to a deep water port. Once used to bring in raw materials to manufacture steel, it now brings in brand new Audis and Volkswagens. Located centrally on the East Coast, nearly a third of the U.S. population is within a day's drive. There's also an on-site rail line that can bring in products in mass directly into the warehouses.
Each boxcar represents roughly four truckloads of flatbed trucks.
Phil Snyder is the general manager of this Home Depot facility. He says all that infrastructure was a big reason the company built a 700,000-square-foot distribution center here in 2019.
What we're seeing is customers want to order what they want, when they want it, wherever they want it. We can put a large labor force in here. We can fit 30 flatbed trucks in an effort to be able to accomplish that for the region.
Home Depot has plans to double its footprint with another center later this year and will employ 500 people at both facilities. But it's not all warehouses. On the northern end of Sparrows Point, Gotham Greens opened a 100,000-square-foot greenhouse last year.
Our goal is to grow locally and distribute regionally, but on a national scale. So this is one of our network of greenhouses in cities across America.
Julie McMahon is a senior brand manager at Gotham Greens. The company hydroponically grows 6 million heads of lettuce here every year and ships directly to surrounding stores.
What we're really trying to do is reimagine these urban landscapes that once were really major hubs for manufacturing, and really coming in and thinking about what the new version of 21st century manufacturing looks like, and maybe that's a local greenhouse.
60 people are employed full-time here. Across all companies combined, there are now 10,000 people employed on TradePoint Atlantic's site. But turning a former steel mill into a distribution center has its challenges.
The biggest obstacle that we really had to work through was the idea that this site, because it produced steel for 125 years, was no longer going to be a steel mill, that it was going to be something different. And getting the community to buy into what that vision is took steps.
It was a lot of skepticism.
Larry Bannerman recalls when Aaron Tamarkio first came out to Turner Station to talk with community members about plans for Sparrows Point. One of Bannerman's main concerns was the environmental cleanup of the former steel mill site.
We want to see the right thing happen with pollution remediation. So that's always been a big thing here.
He remembers the toll working at the steel mill had on his father's health. As a kid, he says, the smokestacks would spew out orange dust that would stain their clothes. And the local beach had to be closed because kids were getting lesions on their skin from swimming in the water.
Can you get in the water now?
No, better not. I mean, you get in a canoe or something, but that pollution over there, it's historic. It's going to take a long time to clean it up.
TradePoint has so far committed over $70 million to clean up the site in an agreement with the Environmental Protection Agency and local officials. Water pumps are filtering contaminated groundwater, and a heavily polluted runoff ditch has already been cleaned up.
You can see the terrain is how uneven it is.
Yeah.
TradePoint also had to figure out what to do with the mounds of slag on site, a leftover byproduct from the steelmaking process that can be toxic.
They basically created land and then built up the land by piling slag on top of it.
Here, they are processing the slag not only to level the site, but also because it makes a great infill to build on.
So this is going to be used as fill material and base material for the new development projects that you see off in the distance over here.
To date, TradePoint and its tenants have invested more than $2 billion to upgrade and redevelop the site, and it's now nearly 60% built out.
It really is a model, I think, for innovation and for transformation.
John Olszewski is the county executive for Baltimore County, a Democrat and a lifelong resident of the area.
As hard as it was for some members of our community to see it go, to now see national companies coming in and thousands of jobs returning, environmental remediation, you know, it's a true community asset now.
But whether thousands of non-union jobs in warehouses can generate the same path to the middle class as the steel industry did for generations of workers is in question. Adjusted for inflation, a new hire at the Sparrows Point steel mill in the mid-90s would have started earning between $21 and $30 an hour, far above the advertised $15 an hour today at companies like Amazon.
How do you respond to the criticism that, yes, you know, there are now 10,000 new jobs, but many of those warehouse jobs do not compare to, you know, the wages and the stability of the jobs that you could get at the steel mill?
They're not steel mill jobs, but we also have to reckon as a country with the fact that those jobs are not necessarily the jobs that are going to be created. And so while there, you know, may not be manufacturing jobs on site in the way that it was at when it was Sparrows Point, and Bethlehem Steel and subsequent iterations, I mean, people were excited to have people working again on site. They were excited to have economic activity.
He also points out that local officials negotiated with TradePoint to ensure that minority-owned local businesses would benefit from the development, like Strum Contracting.
We had a year's worth of work, and in construction, if you have a place to go for a year, you're doing real good.
Strum is a family-owned welding and fabricating company in Baltimore, founded by James Strum and now run by his daughter, Tierra Strum. The company was hired by TradePoint Atlantic to structurally shore up the berth at the Deepwater Port. It was the largest contract they had ever received. To complete the work, Strum created 8 new full-time positions and filled them with welding trainees out of a local workforce development program, doubling its staff.
Construction is one of the easiest ways to make a good wage when you have low barriers to entry and low skill sets. They go from making $7, $8 an hour to, at the bare minimum, $18 to $20 an hour with benefits. So the revitalization of TradePoint Atlantic has allowed firms like Strum Contracting to scale and grow and provide jobs for the community.
Strum also acquired a larger facility in hopes of getting more work from the TradePoint development, building and installing platforms, handrails, and stairs for offshore wind turbines. The Danish company Ørsted has leased 45 acres there as part of its plan to develop offshore wind projects off the coast of Maryland, the first to be completed by 2026.
That hasn't happened yet. It is a risk. I mean, are you worried at all about the future?
I'm not. If we were not ready, this opportunity would pass us by.
Every crane I see moving is a job. And 7 years ago, it was nothing.
While Tamarkiwa acknowledges that these may not all be the manufacturing jobs of the past, he says TradePoint Atlantic is meeting a need in today's economy.
What happened here in Baltimore at Sparrows Point is very emblematic of what's happened across our nation and what happened to the American industrial economy. People want those older economy jobs back, and I don't have the ability to bring them back. I have the ability to respond to the market and provide the best opportunities for job creation in the market that we're in.
This is PBS NewsHour Weekend, Saturday.
Finally tonight, this week marked the 114th birthday of celebrated Mexican artist Frida Kahlo. In her birthplace of Mexico City, she was honored with a rare exhibit 2 years in the making. NewsHour Weekend's Yvette Feliciano has more.
Here in Mexico City, entering the new exhibit honoring the late Mexican painter Frida Kahlo, guests are treated to a multi-sensory experience.
You can get to know Frida, not just as an artist that the world knows, but also Frida in another dimension. You can also listen to the music she listened to. You can find out family secrets and many experiences that enrich this exhibition.
The exhibit, Frida, the Immersive Experience, features 26 of the artist's most iconic works. Some of her most famous paintings, such as Two Fridas, Me and My Parrots, and Self-Portrait with Cropped Hair, are animated and digitally projected onto textured walls. Event organizers hope the installation will transport the audience into the world of Frida Kahlo. Born in 1907, Gallo was involved in a bus accident as a teenager that forced her into months of bed rest where she took up painting. Her painful recovery, more than 30 surgeries in all, makes up much of her legacy and is evident in her work. But organizers and her family wanted to see the fullness of her life reflected in this exhibit.
She was a really kind person, a person with heart, and that is what we want the public to know, not just the artists, but the flesh and blood of Frida.
After more than a year of the coronavirus pandemic, viewers seem eager to immerse themselves in the life and work of this iconic artist.
That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, the Anderson Family Fund, the estate of Worthington Mayo Smith, the Leonard and Norma Chlorfine Foundation, the Rosalind P. Walter Foundation, Koo and Patricia Ewan, committed to bridging cultural differences in our communities, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by Consumer Cellular and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. And by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.